The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 31st of January, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Bert Monroe, Head of Business Development at Hummingbird Resources. HUM is the ticker there, and Bert provides a business and operational update on their gold production and exploration activities in Mali and Liberia. I also have in the podcast Carl Sterrett, Chief Executive Officer and Founder of Shield Therapeutics, STX, the ticker there, and Carl discusses the significance of the positive results from a long-term study into their lead product, Ferrocrew. Plus, it's a Thursday, so Chris Bailey is here talking about bigger companies, FTSE 100 companies releasing news, including BT, Diageo, Unilever, and Shell. I also have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, including lots of other content, including Malky's blog, Big Dish going live in Bristol. Of course, they were on yesterday, but they had more news today, and they plan to launch in 16 other towns, and also SP Angels, Morning View, and content on Valerix there. Plenty there at foxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Bert Monroe, Head of Business Development at Hummingbird Resources. HUM is the ticker. Bert, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Not at all. Good morning, Justin.
Yeah, so you've released yesterday your Q4 2018 production results and operational update, and we'll get into that, and we'll ask some other questions as well and delve into other things going on. But before we do that, as always, Bert, can you just summarise for people not familiar with Hummingbird what you're all about, please?
Absolutely. Hummingbird is an AIM-listed gold company. We've got a producing gold mine in Mali called Yanfolila. It's set to do up to 125,000 ounces of gold production this year. Additionally, we've got a gold project in Liberia, 4 million ounce gold project in Liberia, which is at the development stage as well, as well as a suite of other exploration assets in Mali and Liberia, and a large interest in Kora Gold, which is an AIM-listed exploration business.
Yeah. Well, take us through some of the figures there. And I know you've had a bit of an issue in the last year because you had problems with the pit wall there, pit issues at Yanfolila, at your main sort of gold production there. But take us through what's happening there and how is the sort of remediation work going there?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we had an extremely operationally challenging second half to last year. So just bringing people through the journey, ultimately we commissioned and ramped up to commercial production very successfully at the first half of last year and had a very good second quarter with 33,000 ounces of production. Then as we moved into the second half of the year, we hit a very hard rainy season. We had some operation issues outside of our control. A bridge on a public road was badly damaged, which hindered our ability to bring in equipment. So I guess a few things compounded together, which unfortunately meant we had to revise our guidance downwards, which was extremely frustrating. And it led to us doing certain remediation work as well on the western wall of the Kamana Eastern pit due to some stability issues associated with the wet season. So fair to say, with a very good first half of the year, we dovetailed it with a very operationally challenging second half of the year. So the results weren't nearly as good as we expect or wanted them to be, which was frustrating for everyone. I think importantly, and I think what this RNS showed yesterday is we've put those behind us. We've largely completed the remediation work on the Kamana East pit. And in January, we're looking to be back up at around the 10,000 ounce a month production, which is obviously sort of steady state production. So whilst we had an operationally challenging second half of the year, we did meet the very top end of our revised guidance, which was important and a small win in that respect. But I think most importantly, it's getting right on top of that remediation work, which has gone to budget and gone to plan, which is, I guess, as pleasing as it can be, given that we have to do it. And importantly now, the mining and the plant are running well, so we're back up to full production.
Yeah. So obviously, you said, yeah, because initially, I think the first year you had a guidance of, was it just over 100, wasn't it, 1,000 ounces? And then.
We guided 105 to 115,000 ounces in the first year, which we were on track to do, obviously, 33,000 ounces in Q2 last year. We were certainly on track to do that. And then fundamentally, we had an issue with the pit wall, which meant that for safety reasons, we stopped mining. Basically, a crack developed above the pit wall. Yeah, there was never a significant pit failure at all, but we had to take some of the weight off that pit wall to make sure the crack didn't develop and end to anything. So obviously, we stopped mining below it. We had to move aspects of the mining fleet onto the remediation work. And due to the bridge issue, we couldn't mobilize additional fleet to maintain the mining rates we needed to hit production guidance. So we got a sort of double whammy where we obviously lost tons being mined, and we increased costs with the remediation work. So we had a double hit there, which meant that we revised guidance down and our costs were up. So yeah, extremely challenging and unfortunate second half of the year. But I think we've handled it as well as we could have done, I think, and team's done a great job of completing that remediation work quickly and getting the mine back off operating at that sort of 10,000 ounce a month rate.
Yeah, yeah, and share prices and shares are all about what's happening in the future. You know, this is an historical document now, and it's good to see you are back on track. And you reckon now, like I say, 10,000 a month, hopefully, and cost of production around about 800-850 all-in sustaining costs. Is that right?
Yeah, so we're forecasting 110 to 125,000 ounces production this year, and we've guided to $800 to $850. An ounce AISC. I think part of that AISC is also building in some of the remediation costs, which are falling into Q1. So, as we put it into the document, into that Q4 update, but we're still been completing remediation work through January. So some of that remediation work cost will obviously increase our AISC in Q1. So over the course of the year, we were obviously ideally targeting 800 or below 800 AISC in an ideal world, but due to some of the remediation costs falling in Q1, that they're still the same budgeted cost. There hasn't been an increase in the cost. It's just the fact they've fallen into Q1, not Q4 last year. So subsequently, the Q4 AISC was slightly lower than we guided it would be, and therefore, obviously, the Q1 AISC will be slightly higher than we would be anticipating, and sort of the average for the year, certainly.
Yeah, take us through the second ball mill. What's the decision process behind that, and what's happening with that at the moment?
Yeah, it's another good step forward. So in our feasibility study, it was always intended that we'd have a tertiary crusher, which would be added in year two of the mine life as you move to additional fresh material, having mined out most of the oxide material, so as the ore gets harder. Once we did a trade-off analysis, essentially, for an additional, give or take, $5 million, the second ball mill would allow about a 24% increase in throughput capacity of the plant. So in that respect, the payback period for the additional capital was extremely quick. So we changed the decision from a tertiary crusher last year, and we are putting in a second ball mill. That's currently, the physical ball mill itself is being shipped to site as we speak. The foundations and sort of civil works have started on the ground. So yeah, it's a good project which should have a meaningful impact on production going forward, and obviously looking forward to getting that done. It's due to come online in Q3 this year. So obviously, I guess the tail end of Q3 and Q4, we should see the benefit from a production perspective of having the additional throughput capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, take us through some of what's happening on the exploration side, because last time you came on, you had some cracking results there. What's going on there?
Good memory, Justin. Yes, yeah, we did. So the drilling was obviously completed at the tail end of last year over the Christmas period. And we're currently waiting for the final sets of results. I think there's, not sure what it is exactly, about 15 holes or so still to come with the assays back. So once we've got all those results in, we will obviously release them. So I would hope some point in the next few weeks or so, hopefully in February, by the end of February, I would guess. And then following on from receiving all of the assays back and all of the data back, obviously we will be working on updating our resources and reserves. So obviously following on from that, we'll be looking to bring out updated resources and reserves on the project. And then subsequent to those, we would then be bringing out an updated life of mine study on the project, which would obviously incorporate, hopefully, obviously an increased reserve base, and also the impact of the second ball mill on on the plant's capacity. So those two factors, the results of the exploration drilling program impacting on our reserves and resources, and also the impact the second ball mill will have over the life of mine, we'd obviously be looking to bring out a new life of mine plan showing, obviously, we're expecting hopefully increased annual average gold production over the life of mine.
Yeah, yeah. And elsewhere, I mean, you've got other things going on. What's happening apart from that?
In terms of Hummingbird, obviously, we've got the Liberian asset. There's been a bit of press around the MDA, the Mineral Development Agreement. That is essentially your mining agreement, your 25-year security of tenure. People may remember a couple of years ago, it was signed by the previous president, and then there's been a change of government since. So essentially, we're going through aspects of that process again. So it's just been re-signed by the government, and it now has to pass through Parliament and become an act of law. So we've made some progress on that, which is pleasing, and I hope over the course of this year it will finally be completed and it will pass through Parliament and become an act of law. So that'll be a good step for that project, obviously, to become fully permitted. And obviously lock in all of the various fiscal terms and other agreements and aspects of it. So that's been going on in the background. But fundamentally, our focus as a business is around Yanfolila. It's got, looking at this year's cash flows, it's got very strong cash flows, which obviously we're focusing on making sure we deliver.
Yeah. Well, and do you know what? At the moment, I think gold is looking good. It's just popped above $1,300 an ounce level, and I think a lot of that's off the back of the Fed yesterday saying, they were planning on hiking interest rates because they saw the U.S. economy is very strong. Now they're saying it's not looking as strong. The financial markets have spooked a little bit, and there's problems around the world with global growth, and the eurozone is coming down. Italy's just gone into recession. Germany's close to it. So whenever there's uncertainty ahead, gold is a safe haven. So it's looking quite good at the moment. The gold price, isn't it?
Yeah, the gold price certainly is looking very good. And I think for us as a miner, our job is to deliver the ounces we say we're going to deliver as cheaply as we can. And that will maximize our revenue at any time. So for us, we aren't speculating on the gold price or spending a huge amount of time studying it or analyzing it. Fundamentally, we need to deliver our ounces and we need to deliver them as cheaply as possible. And then, that will maximize our revenue. So that's really our focus.
Marvellous stuff. One final thing, Bert, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not following the story, just give them those three quick reasons in summary why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, the first one I'd give is strong future cash flows, up to 125,000 ounces of production this year at 800 to 850 ASIC. We'll deliver that. The second one I would say is the introduction of this second ball mill will significantly increase the plant throughput capacity and subsequently our life of mine ability to produce more gold per year. And thirdly, it's about exploration. It's about significantly increasing our reserve life, which we believe with 1.5 million ounces of gold in resources outside of reserve, we should be able to do very easily.
Marvellous stuff. Good to chat to you, Bert, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks a lot, Justin. Nice to talk.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Carl Sterrett, Chief Executive Officer and Founder of Shield Therapeutics. STX is the ticker there. Carl, thanks for joining me again.
Oh, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Yes, good. You've had lots of news out of late, and it looks like the market is starting to pay attention, which is nice. And you've got some more positive news out, in fact, positive results of a long-term phase of your sort of product there. And we'll go into the detail of that in a bit. Before we do, Carl, as always, I don't want to assume that people know all about you and the company there. So give us a brief summary. What is Shield all about, please?
So Shield Therapeutics is a specialty pharmaceutical business which is focused on delivering prescription pharmaceuticals to patients who are generally treated by hospital-based physicians rather than general practice. Mm-hmm. We have a lead asset which is called Ferracru, which is a treatment for iron deficiency anemia. We believe it's a novel oral therapy. And that is now approved in the European Union and also in Switzerland. And it is commercialized across most of Europe by our commercial partner, Norgine.
Mm-hmm. Excellent stuff. And Norgine, when did you sign this agreement with them, and when did they start sort of, because I know you were selling it, but they've got a much bigger, their sales team is four times the size, and they paid you upfront sort of 11 million, wasn't it?
They did, yeah. So we signed the deal in September last year, mm-hmm. And then it took them, it took both parties 2 or 3 months just to transition over all of the materials and the rules and regulations and the licenses, etc. So they got on the road. Their reps got on the road in mid-December, obviously into the Christmas break, and then hit the road again in January. Mm-hmm. And as you say, they've got about, just in Germany and the UK alone, they've got about 4 times the number of reps mm-hmm. that we had available. You know, clearly we're a smaller company with more capital constraints. And that was the reason for doing the deal, really. We recognized that Ferrocrew needed a greater share of voice and the capital wasn't easy to get at. So we needed to find a commercial partner. However, that said, you know, we've still got exceptionally good terms. We still get a really good slice of the action, so to speak, from a royalty that ranges between 25% and 40% of sales. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, they paid us £11 million for the upfront, which in itself gave us cash through until 2020 as well.
Yeah, exactly. So you're now in full commercial flow across Europe, but you are looking, hopefully, to commercialise this around other parts of the world, aren't you?
Yes, we're in negotiations in some Asian markets, particularly China, and hopefully, you know, that will lead to something that's productive for the company. And most importantly, the drug is going through an NDA process or a new drug application process with the US Food and Drug Administration, mm-hmm. and they have told us that they will let us know what their decision is around about the 27th of July on what's known as the PDUFA date. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's in full swing, really. Very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and you've had some positive results from long-term tests. Take us through this, please, if you could.
Yeah, I think this is really relevant for us, actually, for Ferrocrew. So a lot of the patients who have anemia, they have the disease caused by a primary disease such as inflammatory bowel disease or chronic kidney disease. And if you take chronic kidney disease, for example, that in itself, you know, it's in the name, it's chronic. Mm-hmm. And once you've got it, you can't really get rid of it. So the anemia, the cause of the anemia is also chronic. So these patients require constant therapy. And a lot of the, or most of the oral therapies that exist, patients won't take for the long term because of the adverse event profile, the lack of tolerance to those drugs. So they end up having to take intravenous iron, which is generally given in an episodic manner. So you have to be ill before you get it because your body has to be really careful with how it deals with excess iron. Mm-hmm. So the ideal scenario for me would be that you have a drug that is well tolerated that patients can take chronically. And the analogy for me would be, you know, if you're a patient who's got a high blood pressure, your physician would treat you for that high blood pressure and keep you on those tablets to stop the high blood pressure coming back. Yeah. That's how I think Ferrocrew can work. It's a product that patients, this data out to a year of treatment clearly demonstrates that Ferrocrew is well tolerated in the patients who take it. And also it maintains their hemoglobin levels, so they don't need any other intervention. So yeah. I think it's really important. It gives a great foundation, additional foundations to the evidence base for Ferrocrew. So we now have 2 pivotal studies in 2 different patient populations that have come back positive. And then both of those studies went into a long-term phase out to at least 52 weeks. And in both of those long-term studies, we have got data that shows that the benefit of Ferrocrew was maintained and patients didn't relapse into an anemic state and the drug was well tolerated. So yeah. I think really, really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so what's next now? I know, obviously, there's a big milestone in July with America and all that, but what can, say, investors or people with you on their watch list expect news-wise from you?
So I think in the near term, we have data coming out on another study where we are comparing Ferrocrew to the leading intravenous product. And I think that's quite interesting in that product, Ferinject, has, in 2018, the guidance says that it will have sold 800 to 850 million Swiss francs of product. So it's, you know, and it's growing very, very aggressively. Mm-hmm. But it's still intravenous iron. So, you know, our aim with Ferrocrew is to provide patients with an alternative to intravenous iron, but it's clearly a very attractive market. Mm-hmm. So we've been running a non-inferiority study comparing those two products with each other. And that data will be out later through, you know, we'll have it out before the end of Q1. Mm-hmm. We will have our prelims out in April, And then it all leads really towards the PDUFA date at the end of July. And that's really the big one because, you know, the US market is more than 30% of the world's global prescription pharmaceutical market just in its own. Mm-hmm. So a highly attractive, it's the gem really.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Carl, well, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing here, the progress you're making, but not following the story, just give them three quick reasons in summary why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I'd like to think that this is a company that, you know, has great foundations. We've got cash going into 2020 already. There's other deals to be done, as I've alluded to, in the US and in China in particular. This is a company that already has its main asset approved and being commercialized. And it's being commercialized by a really excellent partner that has a really great level of resource, as we've demonstrated, you know, four times the number of reps already promoting the drug than we were able to put out into the field. And yet there's still great potential left, particularly with the FDA's review of Feraccru ongoing. So exciting times for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Carl, good to chat to you. And like I say, lots happening. So no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Very good. Very good. Thanks, Justin.
Apart from freezing to death, almost, it is chilly out there, isn't it? I mean, do you know what? The scenes from America are crazy, aren't they?
Oh, my goodness, the Americans don't have to do the big chill, don't they? There's something else. Polar vortex and all of that. We don't want a bit of that coming across the Atlantic. It's cool enough here as it is.
Yeah.
Roll on summer.
I just can't understand how cold that's getting. It's so cold, telling people, first of all, not to go out. If they go out, try not to breathe or talk too much. It's like you can't go out for long if you don't want to breathe.
The whole breathing thing's a bit difficult. It's not breathe deeply, isn't it? My goodness,
that's
it's
right.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't run in the snow, basically, is probably the advice. Thank goodness we have the stock market to warm us up.
Yeah, well, do you know what? BT's looking cold. It's come out with this is it third quarter results, I think it is, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yes.
What's happening?
Yes,
is it down, as I'm looking right now, it's down 3.64% to £2.25. That is broken below the 200-day moving average, which previously it's got a bit of support from, and it's been above that. So I don't know what's happening here. What's happening, Chris?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because also, if you look at today's quarter three numbers, trading update, EBITDA, not perhaps the most highest quality insight into a company, but nevertheless, they stick it out there. EBITDA at the top end of their range. That's not a shocker. And obviously, previous times, this hasn't been a time for confirming things like dividends and whatever. They've stuck to their dividend like a limpet. Look, I think with BT, it's all about where's it going next? And I think there's a little bit of residual fear that obviously today is the last day of Gavin Patterson's CEO tenorship. And the question is, the new guy joining tomorrow, starts tomorrow. He's been with the company apparently for a few weeks running around their various operations. Is he going to kitchen sink it as perhaps new guys sometimes do? Because undoubtedly he's going to focus on costs and trying to change the business in the future. So the question is, you know, what does this mean for shareholders? You know, is he going to slash the dividend in order to fund extra CapEx or some big technology shift? I don't think so personally. I think this is just fear of the unknown. Today's presentation document is really thin, as befits the fact that it is the last day.
Yeah, you can't be bothered to do anything. Oh, I'm not filling that out.
You know, I had a pace through it before coming on here. 14 pages. Most of it is Gavin Patterson, you know, da-da-da, et cetera. There's a few bits and bobs. Look, Openreach numbers weren't great. The consumer numbers were good. BT's pushed through some price increases. That's worked. The global services bit, which was a bit dodgy historically, that's sort of, the numbers aren't great, but they're not getting any worse. So, you know, you put it together from an operational perspective, BT is undoubtedly a work in progress. No doubt about that. My observation is they've now got a chairman. He's been there now for a thick end of a year. Ex Rio Tinto, turn that business around as chair. I think he'll do the same with BT. And a new CEO starting tomorrow from Worldpay. WorldPay, who came out of RBS, of all places. WorldPay, hugely successful business, done a good job there, and actually I think will turn BT a bit more on in terms of technology and related matters, which for a telecoms company is now hugely important. You know, we always used to remember that TMT phrase back in the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in today's telecoms companies, they truly are technology, telecoms, and media. So for me, BT is a clear buy for 2019. And I must admit, today's move, if people are not particularly excited, I'm happy to take the opposite view on that.
Yeah. So let me ask you a couple of things, terminology-wise, because you're over this. So they say reported profit before tax is 2.09 billion, but it's up 20%. Now, adjusted profit before tax is down 1%. Now, they say adjusted, and it's specific items. So they're saying these are one-off things. Are they or what?
Yeah, that's right. You've got, what BT's got is a lot of restructuring spend, and so that would, the sort of the lower number would take account of that. So bottom line is BT really isn't growing. We know that at the moment. That's pretty obvious. However, what it is doing is chucking out cash to fund the dividend and the pension and obviously ongoing general capex. So absolutely, the numbers for BT are complex. There's no doubt about that. But ultimately, it trades on a low rating. If you sort of strip out and get to the core in essence numbers, and it's got a high free cash flow yield and obviously a high dividend as well at prevailing share prices. For me, if you're going to take a sort of cautious view of BT, it's that they are never going to be, they're never going to get back to their past glories. But for me, they've got a very good incumbent position in broadband. They've sort of pulled away from spending gazillions in pay TV and BT Sport. They're doing that much more sensibly now. Openreach, you know, it's not a bad infrastructure company. There's certainly that's a work in progress, no doubt about that. But I think the sum of the parts is worth more. And my feeling is the new guy's just going to rev it up a little bit more, because let's face it, we all know that any company can find, with new ideas and new eyes on it, a few more efficiencies and stuff like that. So not perhaps the best for a BT employee who may find that their life gets a bit more rigorous, but for shareholders, I think the next year and beyond is going to be rewarded.
Yeah, the net debt has gone up since last year. I mean, it's gone down since September, apparently $781 million down. But net debt is now $11 billion compared to 8.9 when it was in 2017. So that's you know, it's a big chunk of that, isn't it?
Yeah, no. Well, you've got timings there as well, and as I say, it's obviously a series of moving parts always with BT. I personally think that when I looked at their cash flow generation, they can actually at the moment fund the dividend and the pension payments, and obviously the ongoing capex. And clearly, the focus of cost control is to try to retain as much of that as possible, whilst obviously reducing the general cost base. And actually, that's been the big success. If you look at the sort of the split of the numbers, that's been the big success story. You know, what they've now got to do is try and rev up things like revenue growth as well. And, you know, things like Openreach has been a bit disappointing, hasn't made them as much money. I think the higher consumer prices they push through obviously is potentially a help there.
Yeah, okay. Well, do you know what? Let's not talk about it anymore because they're dropping even further, down 4% now, so 2.24.
Obviously, but, the conference call is saying something interesting then, but perhaps more than that, Gavin Patterson saying I'm off. But anyway.
Cool. What else are you looking at, Chris?
Well, you know, you've got to say of the big stuff today, Diageo, obviously the spirits company, did a pretty good job in terms of its numbers. Share price reaction pretty positive too today. You know, what struck me about the numbers is Diageo is a big company, but it punched out net sales growth of just shy of 6% in their first half. Most of that is organic growth as well, which is pretty impressive. And, you know, operating profit, underlying operating profit up 12%, dividend up 5%. You know, you can't argue this company, it's a big beast, is actually moving forward in a pretty sensible fashion. When I look below, all the regions were positive, but particularly Asia was very good for them. Asia is now 20% of their business. About 40% of Diageo's business is emerging markets, 20% of the total business is in Asia, and that did very well for them. That really did help the numbers. So, you know, Chinese and Indians and others drinking a little bit more, you know, that cascades through given the size of their population growth. So Diageo, very sensible business. You know, I found it very hard to pick holes in the numbers. The only problem is you look at the share price, it's actually now bumped up to a very big level. You know, 28, 29 quid is a huge level for Diageo shares. They've struggled there in the past. And as a consequence, you know, it makes me think there isn't a lot of overt value here. It's a very good company. I'm sure lots of listeners like their products. But as a shareholder, I'll be saying, well, maybe, you know, take time to lose a few here. I don't own them personally, but it strikes me that the shares are at a big level and are pretty fully priced and good numbers, but everything has a value.
I don't know what happened in June 2016, 24th of June, but they were in 2016, they were bumping, they were trading in a range pretty much from, say, 20 quid to sort of £18.
Yes.
And then they broke above that on June 24th. Yes. And literally they've climbed, well, added a tenner in
it's amazing, Justin, how time, of course, evolves. But of course, that was the referendum date.
Of
course, the pound fell. Diageo makes a bunch of money overseas, and as a consequence, they were perceived as an attractive place, or perhaps it was people going to drown their spirits with spirits, so to speak. Who knows? But yeah, you had the confluence of good trading and the lower pound helped them. Now, prospectively, who knows on Brexit? But prospectively, that benefit, if you like, that. To a translation benefit from a lower pound is fading off. And so what it comes back down to much more importantly is organic growth. And this is where, let's say, Diageo, who are, you know, punching out 3.5% organic growth, is in such a better position, I think, than something like Unilever, which also reported today. Now, Unilever, they said, you know, again, a business which has loads of emerging market exposure. In their case, about 60% of their business is in the emerging markets. And obviously, their average price point is much lower than Diageo's, but obviously, they sell more of their products. But Unilever this morning said that their sales growth, they thought for this year, was going to be at the low end of their range. And, you know, when I looked at the reasons why, it was a bit complex, actually. I mean, it was, sure, they were mucked around in certain individual markets, but basically the Americas, both North America and South America, Latin America, were downright dull for Unilever in 2018 and seemingly continuing into 2019. So, yeah, Unilever is the reverse, if you like. It's not just, you know, overseas and emerging markets is great. You've got to be doing something with it. And when I look at Unilever shares today, which I think have broken below 40 quid this morning, I just don't see value there. You know, of the two, you know, neither are offering overt value between Diageo and Unilever. But if you had to choose one, you would choose Diageo every time because they're still performing.
Yeah.
And, you know, just it just feels, when I read through the statements and everything, it just felt, yeah, you know, these guys, you're paying up for it, but actually they've got a plan and the strong brand and everything else is kind of working for them. So, yeah, Unilever, I think, you know, we've talked about it before, Unilever not offering value in the 40 quid plus range. I think it's proving that today.
Yeah, do you know what? The chart doesn't look very pretty. It seems like it's tested a high at that sort of 45 quid. Or it initially, it was up there in September 2017. It tried to break it again recently. It didn't do it. And now it's heading down. It almost seems like it's over the hill and coming down the back of the other side of the hill there. So,
yes.
Doesn't look very good.
And they had, of course, a year or so ago, they had the bid from Kraft Heinz. They turned it down. They said, you know, we're going to transform the business. This is Unilever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the market actually took that quite well and they believed in them. But obviously they've had now a change of CEO. Paul Polman was the ex-CEO. He kind of ran out of steam, I felt. And now they've got this new guy. Let's see what he does. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, Unilever, I'm not aggressively excited about it. Mm-hmm. And I guess ice cream sales are going to be pretty shabby with all the cold weather.
Yeah.
Not that that's a huge part of their business, but that was always the joke that Unilever, you know, you kind of bought it when it was summer or sunny and sold it when it was winter. But I think they've cracked the business on into a wider range of businesses than Wall's ice cream now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, anything else there, Chris?
The final one's got to be Shell, or Royal Dutch Shell, as most refer to it. Yeah. You know, shares responded well today. Numbers looked solid, as obviously they're benefiting from higher oil prices. Oil prices have been volatile recently, but higher oil prices than a year ago, and other benefits through their operational performance. So, yeah, the numbers perform. You know, the shares performed well this morning, but. You know, the thing is with Shell is that it's funny. Somebody I know very excitedly told me after tremendous amount of research or looking through opportunities that the share they were going to buy was Raw Dutch Shell. And I said, my goodness, that is just so boring. And sent them a chart showing the correlation of the Raw Dutch Shell chart with the FTSE 100 chart. I said, it's just easier and cheaper just to buy a tracker. And it truly is. You know, Dutch, you know, it's a fine business. You know, it's not going to go bust. And I'm sure somebody would be saying, look, the 6% yield is very exciting to me, but believe me, total return basis, it's FTSE 100-esque. I mean, yeah, I'm not excited. The share has slipped back a bit, and it's obviously reversing some of those losses today, which may be the reason why we've got a bit of an outsized reaction. But honestly, if you know, Shell is fine as ballast for a portfolio. I guess you're not gonna go too far wrong. But if you're overtly very excited about this one, then my goodness, you really should be looking in the wider brethren of stocks and everything else.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as it comes back to below 20 quid, there's no point to even looking at it really. But I think probably the oil price will come off a little bit. Like I said, it's coming lower, and we're getting a global slowdown. So. I can't see it. You know, I can't see it getting a lot higher in the next couple of months.
Well,
can you?
Well, what happens is it's a bit complex, but essentially the operational numbers refer to a period of time because it takes sort of like a while for a lower oil price to sort of come in.
Yeah.
The fall in the oil price in the last sort of quarter or so of last year will only start impacting the next set of numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit complex. The lags and whatever within businesses.
Yeah, yeah.
So at the moment, you know, Shell's benefiting from some of the romp in oil prices that we saw up to sort of the middle of last year. There's still that sort of residual benefit. That will then kind of fall out. Now, Shell is an integrated business, so undoubtedly people are thinking, well, if they've got lower sort of upstream profitability, that's from exploration, the downstream might compensate, which is absolutely true. But the trouble is often, and this is my observation with Shell, it's very steady, but it kind of is, it's not a really much of a directional bet. You're just playing on the fact that they've got some good fields and in incumbent assets and everything else. My feeling with Shell, it's a downright, it's an all right business, but it's just dull, and it's ballast for portfolios. I would agree that the shares become more interesting nearer £20. I wouldn't be aggressively chasing it here. And if you're bullish about oil and prospects, then look at the services and the E&P businesses, because there's far more leveraged and interesting opportunities there.
Yeah, I mean, last time I bought Shell, it was down to, you know, when we had the share price, and obviously in sentiment, it went down as well, but the oil price was, you know, going below $30, and it touched, I think, it touched 25, didn't it? But Shell went down to about 12 quid. So I think I started piling in. I started piling in a bit too early, actually. I started piling about 18 quid. But I kept averaging down there. This can't keep going. I did so, you know, wake up in the middle of the night one night thinking, oh, I think I've got it wrong here. But no, it did bounce nicely. So, yeah, but at the moment, it's not. It had a bit of a downtrend, though. It's come down from like 28 quid down to 22 quid.
That's right. Yeah, well, that I think is the lower oil price influence in the market. As I say, it hasn't influenced the numbers so much yet. All I say is, put it up on a little one of those graphic packages against the FTSE 100. And when it's at a big old, a decent discount, decent is probably 5 to 10% discount versus the performance of the FTSE, have a think about it. Right at this moment in time, it's bang in line. In fact, year to date, you would have made more money in a FTSE 100 tracker than you would in Shell, despite today's bounce, which I think says it all.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Thanks, Chris, and we'll catch up next week, fella.
Sounds a plan.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Cadogan Petroleum, CAD. At four, U Group, that's YU dot. At three, GCM Resources, GCM. At two, Staffline, that's Staff, ticker. And number one most followed company is Red Emperor Resources, RMP. Okay, top five most liked RNSs come from the following companies. At five, 88 Energy, corporate presentation. At 4, Valorix, new patent grant allowances for Val 301. At 3, Oriel Resources, resolution and VAT dispute to deliver £500,000. At 2, Management Resource Solutions, MRS, change advisor. And number 1, most liked RNS, is a quarterly activity and cash flow report from Europa Metals EUZ. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.